Shana Aronson is joining us on the line. She's head of Jewish Watch, and she's been involved in trying to determine and trying to prove that Malka Leifa is fit to stand trial. Shana, very, very good morning to you, and thank you for taking the time to speak to us.
Sure. Good morning to you.
Can you just, for anybody who doesn't know the very basics of the case and who might have just tuned in, can you just tell us headlines what the case is about?
Absolutely. So Malka Leifa was a woman who, an Israeli woman initially. She was living, she had gone to Australia to work as a school principal for the ultra-Orthodox girls' school there. And she was there for a few years. And then she was accused by, some of the students started coming forward. Rumors started, you know, sort of circling around in the community that she had sexually abused some students. She was immediately spirited onto a plane and sent back to Israel. And then a couple years later, after the victims did, or three of the victims, very, very courageously went forward to law enforcement, sort of started the beginning of that proceeding to start the extradition process. And since then, you know, in 2010, sort of this whole thing started. And then it has dragged on and dragged on and dragged on. In 2016, you know, her attorneys had been claiming that she was so unfit that she couldn't show up for court. So, you know, initially the way it works in Israel is, sex offenders are usually, after they've been, you know, initially brought into court, they're usually let out on bail. It's very standard here. So she'd been let out, and every time she was supposed to, you know, appear for a hearing, she just wouldn't show up. And her attorneys kept saying she was just mentally unwell. She had checked herself into the hospital a couple days before. Sort of coincidentally, she would check herself into the hospital a couple days before the hearing and then check herself back out again a couple days after. They said that the hearings themselves were bringing on such intense anxiety that she, you know, just wasn't fit. But in 2016, a judge ruled that that was unacceptable, that she was in fact not, that she wasn't fit at this point based on the assessment of a district psychiatrist in Jerusalem. And they said that every 6 months she should be reassessed and to see if she would be fit at that point. And, you know, 6 months went by, the psychiatrist still said she was unfit. Another 6 months went by and another. And, you know, it was sort of blatantly obvious to, I think, anyone that has been following the story at all that she was faking it. There's no question in mind. The woman was a successful school principal, was living in Israel absolutely fine, and then suddenly develops this extreme mental illness only around the court hearings. So that was where Jewish Community Watch got involved.
So the part of the tragedy here, and I think part of the disgrace here, is that she hasn't behaved alone. She hasn't acted alone. And I'm not suggesting during her behavior in Melbourne, but certainly in Israel, she has been, her behavior has been aided and abetted by some very prominent people. Which is, I guess, all the more frustrating. How did Jewish Watch get involved, and what was your role in all of this?
So JCW got involved in the end of 2017, I think November it was, if I'm not mistaken. Dasi, Nicole, and Ellie, who are the survivors in this case, the three that did go forward to the police, they came to Israel to try to do some, to try to speak to some members of, you know, of parliament and of just to try to, with the media, and try to just raise some public pressure and awareness of this case to try to move it forward. And someone actually had said, it was suggested to him that I meet with them while they were here. And I really didn't think there was anything that we could do to help. But when I met with them, I was just really blown away, because I've met some incredibly, incredibly courageous survivors in the course of my, you know, work with JCW, and all of us, all of our team, you know, we really meet unbelievable people who are just so, full of so much bravery and inspiration on a regular basis. But what they had done here, they had sort of taken on these roles of advocates and of like attorneys and of politicians. They had sort of, they had just rallied for themselves in a way that I'd never seen anything like this before. I mean, literally to the point, we're talking like heads of state that they managed to get involved. And it was really unbelievable to me. And I asked them kind of like, what are, sort of behind the scenes, what are they hearing? And they had shared with me that, you know, one of their lawyers, their lawyers were saying that like this mental illness thing is really problematic, that they're continuing to be able to do this And I had asked, I think it was around 6 months prior to my meeting with them, there was an image, a photo that had been sort of like put on Facebook, of Lifer. It's a very grainy photo, but it's very clear that it's her. And she was in the city of Meron for Lag BaOmer, which is a lot of people make that trip up there. And she was just walking around. I mean, she was just clearly just fine. And I had asked them why that photo wasn't more helpful in, you know, showing, and they had shared with me that that photo couldn't be authenticated in an official manner. The person that had taken the photo didn't want to, you know, wasn't willing to actually go to the police and confirm that they had taken the photo. So the photo was really worthless as far as what law enforcement was concerned. And I asked them, you know, if it could be proven that if evidence was brought that she's just fine, that she's living her life, then would that help? Right. And they said, I think they, you know, they thought so. So it seemed pretty clear that that could make a difference. So I immediately called our director, who is, you know, in Florida, works out of our main U.S. office. And I told him about this meeting and, you know, said, I think, you know, maybe we should consider doing this. And he said, absolutely. And so we right away got on the phone with the private investigator and we decided to do this over, the holiday of Hanukkah because we thought there was the greatest chance that she would, you know, there would be events or family gatherings or something.
She would participate.
And there was what to see. Yeah. So that was where we got involved. And thankfully it was, it certainly, it revealed what we thought it would reveal.
That she's leading a pretty normal, in inverted commas, a normal life.
Yeah.
But there's also clearly cognitive dissonance or absolute denial from her family because to carry on as though nothing has happened and that these allegations don't exist against her, you've got to be pretty resolute in your desire to shut out reality.
Absolutely. But that I think is something that we see oftentimes with and the behavior of both abusers and their loved ones.
Yes, in fact, I mean, wanted to go there because, yeah. You know, this one case aside, you're involved, and I went onto the website, and I have to tell you that I scrolled through some photos that were of what I would have perceived as normal people or religious looking normal people. And it actually brought tears to my eyes because you just go through pages and pages of people. And it's not that you are irresponsibly naming and shaming each person. And I want to make that point clear to our listeners, each person, there is a link that you can open up and you can see exactly what they've been charged with. If they've served time, if they're on a sex offender registry, etc. So it's not just that somebody makes an allegation and this picture is put up, but the number of these incidents broke my heart to look at.
Yes, it's pretty horrifying, and I've heard that often from people the first time they're exposed to that particular page on our website, which lists, you know, the offenders. It's mind-boggling because it looks like these people look like your neighbors. They look like you and me. They look like anyone. They just could be anybody. And that is, it's an important, I mean, that in itself is an important message for parents, for anyone in a child caring, you know, position that, you know, offenders do not have horns and green skin and they're not the sketchy man in the park with the, you know, with the trench coat. They are usually the people that are, you know, sort of right in your immediate vicinity, which is why it's so important to be aware and, you know, learn the signs and have open communication with your children about personal safety and boundaries, and, you know, be vigilant about the schools, the camps, that you're sending your children to, you know, everything like that, because it's usually where you don't expect it.
And unfortunately for the kids, it's where their guard is down as well, because they are told, we've reinforced, well, you're at a synagogue or you're at a camp or you're at a church. You know, these are places that we would expect our kids to be safe. And I think that's the biggest danger, unfortunately.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Children are black and white thinkers by definition. It's just how the way their minds work. So trying to explain to a child, I mean, that's why we also, you know, very much believe children can't protect themselves from abuse. And that's very important. There are unfortunately a lot of, child safety, you know, sort of educational programs out there that kind of focus on this idea that if you teach your children enough about abuse, they'll be able to protect themselves. And that really isn't true, because children, no matter how much you teach them, they're never going to really fully understand. They're never going to be capable of protecting themselves against an adult who is intent on hurting them. The adult is, you know, outranks them, so to speak, in every single way, physically, mentally, cognitively, just everything. So it's so important that we be involved, and that as a community, we be vigilant bystanders, because children can protect themselves. We can help, you know, create resilience in children. We can certainly help them so they understand more what's going on, and so that they're more assertive in, you know, telling the safe adults in their life if something happens. But ultimately, they can't really be responsible for their own protection, and that leaves it to us as the adults and as the community.
Absolutely, and there we do have to leave it. I've been chatting to Shana Aronson. She's head of Jewish Watch. Can you just give us the website address?
Yes, it's jewishcommunitywatch.org. All one word, of course, and I am the COO of the organization.
Just keep up the great work, and I just wish that one day you don't have any work to do. That would, you know, sadly, I doubt that is ever going to be a reality, but that is my wish. Time is 8:58. I'm Howard Feldman. This is Your Morning Mayhem on 101.9 Chai FM.